Welcome to the last educational session of This Living Future. Thanks for coming. So this section, model, remodel, renovation for massive change, is all about how in real life we can apply the Living Building Challenge to existing homes, whether that's a single family home, conversion of single family to maybe multiple units depending on the size, or a small scale multifamily into a living multifamily. Where I am honored today to be able to introduce some total rock stars, I think, in this field. These are folks that have been doing green building for quite a long time and realize the intricacies of greening up an existing project, whether it's down to the swinging a hammer level or drawing it out in plans and actually getting it permitted. Pretty exciting stuff. So we've got Kelly Lerner, first of all. Kelly Lerner is co-author of Natural Remodeling for the Not-So-Green House, Bringing Your Home into Harmony with Nature, which is actually down in the bookstore, and principal architect of One World Design Architecture in Spokane, Washington. In 2005, Natural Home Magazine named her as one of the top 10 eco-architects in the United States. She received the United Nations World Habitat Award for spearheading a project that introduced straw bale construction to China and built over 600 sustainable straw bale homes. She has committed her residential practice to the design of healthy, beautiful, carbon-neutral homes throughout the Northwest, and her ecological design work and writing have been published in Metropolis, Dwell, Natural Home, Landscape Architecture, Design of Straw Bale Buildings, Alternative Construction, The Straw Bale House, Serious Straw Bale, The New Straw Bale House. So you can tell some of the materials she works with. Green by Design and Building Without Borders. Our second panelist and presenter is Stephen Aguier. He's the Stefan. Sorry, I knew I was going to. Okay, I like put all of the pronunciation elements for the last name and then screwed up the first name. He's the founder and president of Green Hammer Incorporated, a Portland-based residential building contractor committed to advancing the highest standards of green building. Established in 2002, Green Hammer is dedicated to building durable, high-quality homes and remodels that incorporate the use of natural, local, and non-toxic materials with the most advanced energy and water conservation systems and techniques available. Stefan and the team at Green Hammer work diligently to leverage their experiences and accomplishments to show the green building market, to grow the green building market in the Pacific Northwest, making responsible materials, techniques, and management systems more prominent, efficient, and accessible. And I think that this has been extremely successful for Stefan. I think he's been in kind of a high-class conundrum on how to keep his business small and meaningful in face of the demand that he's been facing for his services. So that's for those of you with small businesses out there. I think that this kind of tells you where the industry is going. In 2005, he co-founded the Build Local Alliance as a forum for connecting local forest stewards practicing FSC-certified forestry to builders and architects in the Portland region. In 2007, Stephen was recognized as a local leader in the green building movement and was elected to serve as board chair for the Columbia West chapter of the Northwest Eco Building Guild. Finally, we have Terry Phelan. And Terry is the principal architect of Living Shelter Design, which is based in Issaquah, Washington, my hometown. I moved there when I was 4 years old, by the way. Maybe too much information. Firm specializing in deep green home and small community design. She served on the board of the Northwest Eco Building Guild since 2002 and as its vice president since 2004. Terry has over 30 years' experience in the residential design industry, with the last 14 focused on finding truly sustainable solutions for homes in the wide variety of climates and settings of the Pacific Northwest. Her published works have appeared in Mother Earth News, Natural Home, Conscious Choice, Green by Design, The New Straw Bale House, and The Daily Journal of Commerce. So with that, a couple of housekeeping points. I think y'all probably know at this point where the washrooms are, end of the hall, left or right, depending on gender. We do have continuing education units for this course as well. I'm going to be custodian of the list until the end of the class, and I'll be in the back for anyone that wants to sign it at the end. But without further ado, I'll have Kelly start with a presentation about an actual project that she has worked on, moving it toward living building status, basically from a standard owner-built A-frame vacation home into a living building.
So anyone ambitious enough to try and introduce straw bale construction to China might be apt to take on something like an owner-built A-frame from the 1970s, uninsulated, and change it into a living building. They sort of seem tasks of similar magnitude to me. But before we get started, I want to know who's in the audience. So how many landscape architects? Great. How many interior designers? Okay. How many contractors? Oh, yeah, good. How many architects? Government officials? Hey. Owner builders? Yay. Homeowners? Okay. Anybody I'm missing? Other categories? Engineers? Oh, sorry. Forgot the engineers. Anybody else I've forgotten? That public relations. Excellent. Marketing. Telling our story.
Salesmen.
Salesmen telling our story. Great. Consultants. So, the Living Building Challenge. I've always been kind of resistant to working with checklist systems like LEED or Built Green because they always feel kind of confining to me. And the actual truth of the matter is when I start working with these checklist systems, I usually fail because I'm doing something that just doesn't even show up. And, you know, I'm not meeting the prerequisites or I'm not meeting the criteria. And so whenever I hear about a new system, I'm always like, I don't know. But the Living Building Challenge really caught my attention because it's so straightforward and simple, and I really loved the purpose, which is to define the highest measure of sustainability possible in the built environment based on the current thinking, recognizing that sustainability is not yet possible. So we've got a lot of elements in there. Highest measure, built environment, sustainability. And we recognize that we're not there yet, and it's kind of a moving target. So I got pretty excited about that, and also about the fact that there are no credits, just prerequisites. This is my kind of game. I'm pretty excited. So how many of you are familiar with the Living Building Challenge by now? This is the last session. So if you haven't gotten it by now, this is your last chance, and I'm excited you're here. So we've got these 16 prerequisites, and you must meet them all to comply. And at this point, many of the prerequisites have exceptions, and these exceptions are intended to acknowledge that there are market realities. You know, this is our little reality check, the exceptions. And the standard, we want it to be really challenging, but not impossible to attain. So we're just going to go through this project that I've been working on in Winthrop, Washington, or it's between Twisp and Winthrop, and we're going to say, how did we do, and, you know, what are the questions? One thing I really want you to do during this whole presentation is to be thinking of all the things that I missed somehow, or that this project missed. Where did we miss the mark? But I also want you to be thinking about where does the Living Building Challenge miss the mark? You know, is the intention clear, but maybe the prerequisite not quite right? So I want you to all put on your very Missouri hats, your show me hats, your devil's advocate. Wait. Can't we make this a little bit better? Can't we make this a little more fine-tuned? Because we have a great opportunity with the Living Building Challenge right now. It's in its very beginning stages. It's half-baked or maybe three-quarters baked, and we have a chance to bake it the rest of the way. One thing that I also really like about the Living Building Challenge is there are these 16 prerequisites, but they also sort of acknowledge that you might not be able to make it on all of them. So they're dividing them into categories of the petals. And if we go back, we can see, You know, there's three in site design, one in energy. We've got a lot in materials, a couple in water, a lot in indoor, and three in indoor environmental quality, and two in beauty and inspiration. So you can see the petals there. And I'm just going to take you through this project really quickly. It was an owner-built A-frame. It's from the 1970s. And here are the as-built drawings. You can see first floor on the far right-hand side, the upstairs floor, which was, you know, very low and very small, and the just basic section there. And there was a dormer off to the east. And then we go from, take a look at this again, you know, first floor as built, second floor as built, and this is what we decided to do with it. Basically add a living room off to the west side. It's a straw bale addition, so you can see the original rectangle and then the big box coming off the left-hand side, and also a mudroom pantry entry there. And we decided to keep the whole east side of the A-frame that had the kitchen in it and it had the bathroom in it, so we're keeping all that plumbing, keeping all those utilities, keeping all those things, basically cutting the A-frame down the ridge and saying we're going to keep everything on the east and get rid of everything on the west and rebuild it. So it went from a simple A-frame to something that looks like this. And one of my devil's advocates with the Living Building Challenge remodeling is, shouldn't there be some prerequisite right at the beginning for using what's already there on site, either in terms of materials or the building, or, you know, at least analyzing what your site resources are and making use of those? Big question mark. Should the Living Building Challenge include something like that? I think so. And I'm just going to go through the prerequisites here, how we met them or didn't meet them. Responsible site selection. You know, here we are. We're between Winthrop and Twisp, north central Washington, not within 50 feet of wetlands, not adjacent to or on a sensitive habitat. We're not on prime farmland, but it is agricultural. It has been agricultural. It is remaining agricultural. And not within the 100-year floodplain. We are obviously on a previously developed site. There is the little original A-frame. with habitat exchange, we're still trying to figure out what that means for a rural site. You know, a lot of this site is undeveloped. We did not touch anything that wasn't already touched. There is wildlife that goes through there. I would say this one in some ways is still in process in our minds in terms of figuring out what exactly does habitat exchange mean for a rural, previously developed, pretty wild site. So, big question mark there. My focus in my practice lately really has been on net zero energy projects, or as a friend of mine likes to say, Kelly, make them positive, carbon positive projects. So we're going to look a little bit at what we did to make this a net zero energy project. Of course, the first thing you always want to do is address your envelope, get super insulation so that you don't need a lot of energy to begin with. So the addition was straw bale, R60 cellulose insulation in the ceiling, passive solar design, a lot of focus towards the south, closed down towards the west because it's a fairly hot climate there. Here you can see some of the large south-facing windows, but also good shading outside. An interesting thing that the client wanted to do was have an indoor planting bed. Now, this project just got finished this last fall and over the winter, so some things aren't, you know, fully in place yet. But here's going to be their planting bed right in the south south windows there. Another thing that we face in Washington in general is that we have this climate where we have lots of sun in the summer and the fall, but we don't have much sun for passive solar during our coldest months. So you have to figure out how to bank some of that heat from the summer and the fall and save it for the winter in some way. And this is an idea and an illustration out of Solar Water Heating by Bob Ramlow, if any of you have seen that book. And it's a great book. And what he's an engineer from Wisconsin, and what he is suggesting is to put a large sand bed under your slab if you're doing slab on grade, and to run tubing through the bottom of it to insulate this whole sand bed. Imagine it's a big insulated bathtub of sand underneath your slab, to run your PEX tubing through that and to start heating it up in August, September, October. So you heat the whole sand, and then the sand radiates up slowly through the slab. So you're using your sand as a huge thermal mass sink. Now, sand, it's not a great insulator, but it's not a great conductor either. It sort of conducts very, very slowly. And Bob would say that it conducts at about a foot a month. Now, I think that really depends on the moisture of the sand and the delta T and a lot of other variables. And I don't think the system is completely worked out, and yet it does make a lot of sense to be storing this heat from the summer and trying to use it in the wintertime. I'm not sure that this is the best way to do it, but I'm sure experimenting with it. So here you can see the rest of the system. We were looking at sort of the underground part of the system there. But what you do is have a solar hot water collector array, goes to a heat exchanger that and ties into a domestic hot water system, and then goes through these floor circuits. For the summertime, you need some sort of shunt loop or loop that will take the heat away, because imagine you have this huge collector array. You got to dump that heat somewhere in the summertime or shade your array in some ways. But you get domestic solar hot water and you get heating out of this. So here we are. We've poured the footings and the stem walls for the insulation. And you can see the PEX tubing down on the insulation, the whole bathtub of insulation, if you will. The planting bed is off to the far left there. We've just got that down in the bottom corner. And the PEX tubing is in, and we're pouring the sand in. Now, Bob recommends dry sand. Of course, we poured dried sand in, we compacted it, and it rained before we poured the slab. So there is moisture in the sand, which makes the heat storage capacity larger, but it also makes the conduction faster. There you can see the finished product and the solar array off on your left-hand side. The little photovoltaic panels are what's running the pump for the whole thing. Now, this array will ultimately probably be sized to between 6 and 8 collector panels. These are heliodyne panels, flat plate collectors. We thought about evacuated tube collectors, but realized that in this climate, the vacuum tube collectors don't have enough heat loss to melt off the frost. And so what we really wanted was flat plate collectors that had a little bit more heat, or a little bit more heat coming off them, so they could melt off snow or frost. We also decided to put these collectors on the ground, which was a good thing, because they can take snow off of them. But the problem with that is we had a pretty long run to the house. So there's some, you know, heat losses and a lot of expense associated with getting that hot water back to the house. And the idea with only having 3 collector panels to begin with is we're going to monitor this system over time and figure out if that's the right number or we need more. And one of the things with a residential remodel is that you're trying to figure out, look at it incrementally, so that you do one thing and then monitor it and see how it works, and do another thing and monitor and see how it works, and try and figure out the system as you go along, or fine-tune the system as you go along until you get to a living building, because it might not be quite as clear from the very beginning what the things are to do. So here you can see we've got monitors in the slab, the top of the sand, mid-sand. There's the in from the panels at 110. We've got the return coming back at 73. So you can see that there is heat. This is on a March day, actually. So you can see that the return there at 73, in from the panels at 110, you know, we're dumping a bunch of heat in that sand. In mid-sand, 87 degrees. When you get to the top of the sand, 72, that's almost in a steady state with the slab there. The other thing that is in the Living Building Challenge is basically no combustion appliances, and we did use a masonry stove, so this may knock us out completely here. But we have a masonry stove. We decided to use that because we needed a big chunk of thermal mass for the existing building for cooling mode as well as heating mode. And the plan is for the clients that they're going to be growing trees and coppicing trees, cutting off the branches of the trees in a real managed way as the heat source, as a backup heat source, basically. So we don't really know how the sand bed system is going to work. We think it's going to work. We think it's going to work fine. We don't know if it's going to heat the whole house. This is the backup system, and it also provides a lot of thermal mass for the house. It's unclear to me whether they'll continue to use the masonry stove and need to use that continuously as backup, or whether they can phase that out over time. One of the things with a sand bed heating system is that it takes several years to sort of come up to temperature and be effective. So this is a long-term design process. Jumping to materials, we had a big decision to make with materials. Here you can see the existing A-frame. We're taking it apart. You can see how it was built, basically 2x6 rafters with skip sheathing over it, barely even skip sheathing, more like purlins. And on the east side, which we left intact, which is over by the pink wall there, that's the east side, we had to decide how to insulate that existing wall. And we didn't really want to touch it. We didn't want to, in terms of adding to it, we didn't want to add a whole nother layer of structure on top of it to give us more thickness. And we wanted to make it as airtight as possible. And we really didn't want to have to sheathe the whole thing and make use of all those materials. And finally, we decided that the best solution probably would be a spray foam. And then we started looking at the different spray foams that are available. Aircrete, which is like a mineral-based spray foam, but not available at all in Central Washington. Isonene, not available at all in Central Washington. Probably available on the west side, but to get somebody to come, probably cost prohibitive. Bio-based spray foam insulation, which has a soy oil, and then just regular polyurethane, right, spray foam insulation from Geico. And as we went down the list, you know, I was like, Dune, we really should be using this bio-based. And I love these clients. What she said to me, Kelly, you know, we're talking on the phone, right? Kelly, so do you know where those soybeans come from? Are they grown in Brazil? Did they cut down rainforest and release all that carbon to grow those soybeans? And are they genetically modified? I can get polyurethane spray foam insulation here. We're saving all this wood. We're saving all this labor. It's cost effective. We're going for net zero energy. That's our highest priority. And I said, yeah, you're right. So, you know, we used a polyurethane spray foam insulation. In terms of, you know, carbon footprint, we're also still in process on that. We're waiting until the project is done to sort of list out all the materials and see where we are from a carbon footprint perspective. The clients are totally committed to buying carbon offsets. And we went back and forth an awful lot at the very beginning of the design process to say, would it be better to just, like, trash this building and build a new one? Because you can see that this building was, like, not the best building in the world to begin with. And so when I was up there in March, I asked her, you know, would you do it differently? Would you keep the, you know, the east side of the building still, or would you just start over? And she said, no. We felt like that was a good decision. We're glad we retained those materials and that plumbing and the cabinets and the bathroom and everything. So that was nice to hear. In terms of responsible industry, we had a really hard time finding FSC lumber. We could have got it shipped from Bellingham, but we looked at sort of the carbon footprint of transporting all that lumber over to Central Washington versus using local, sustainably harvested sources that we knew that were not FSC certified, but sources that we knew the people knew where it was coming from, knew how they managed their forest sources, and that's what we ended up doing. So I would push a little bit on the Living Building Challenge there that, you know, if FSC isn't available everywhere and the carbon footprint of actually getting it to where you are is really large, does it make more sense to use a local source? And is there some other way besides FSC of certifying that makes sense, that it is sustainably harvested? Because the client did go to great lengths to know where her wood was coming from. The other thing where we did use a lot of salvage materials from the contractor on this project that he had been saving up at his site around there. And then the other thing that we really struggled with in terms of materials was windows. We looked at several different possibilities. The Lowen FSC certified windows were not out at that point yet. That would have been a possibility. Ultimately, we went with Vetter windows. They're manufactured by Peachtree. They're in Wisconsin. They manage, and that, you know, that'll show up obviously in the service radius. But we there we go, appropriate materials radius. But it's both, you know, it has to, wood windows. Do you need to have your windows FSC certified? Does every stick of wood in the project need to be FSC certified? Or again, if it's coming from a sustainable source that you've researched, is that a possibility? Anyway, Vetter makes their windows in Wisconsin. They manage their own forests. They are managing for long-term manufacturing because they want to keep going as a business. And she called around different manufacturers, and she just felt like Vetter had the best management practices in terms of their forests and everything else, and ended up going with Vetter windows. I haven't gone to, because we are, this building is still in process, so we haven't weighed out all the materials to know how we are with the weight of the windows and the appropriate materials radius yet. So that one is still kind of up in the air, still being analyzed. One of the other things that was in the house is they had bamboo flooring already. We saved as much of it as possible. They put a little bit new bamboo flooring in, a very small amount, but they were matching the existing there. And, you know, bamboo flooring, rapidly renewable resource, but coming from a really long ways away. But that's a good question for remodels, is if you have something you're trying to match, because you're saving, you know, 100% of the original, and then you want to match that, can you have that little bit of material from a very far, far place in order to match the original? I don't know. In terms of construction waste, we recycled everything that there were facilities to recycle in the Winthrop Twisp area. I would say nearly every stick of wood got carried off to some other project, or, you know, was recycled, chipped up on site, or burned on site. Does that count? I don't know. You know, it's a good question. In a rural site and in a rural location, what do you do about recycling? What if the carbon footprint of getting the gypsum board to recycling means you need to drive it to Seattle? Does that make sense? I don't know. I tend to think not, but, you know, we have to have some way of accounting for that within the system. Another big question on water, net zero water. It's a very laudable goal, and we talked a lot about rainwater collection. We have great roofs for it here. We have some, you know, upper roofs, so we could even have an elevated cistern, and we were talking about all this. Where would the cistern go and the composting toilets and da-da-da-da-da? And then I said, now wait a second. Okay, you're pumping your water. You don't even have a very deep well. You're pumping your water out of the aquifer, we're using the water in the house, it's going into a septic system that's basically a ground biological treatment, and then it's going right back down into the aquifer, all on your site. Why would we build a cistern, pressurize the system, put in all that infrastructure instead of just using the natural system that's already there. Now, I understand about failing septic systems and that they can pollute groundwater, but if you have a good functional septic system, you know, should you go, you know, isn't that a working biological treatment system? So I think there are questions about using the aquifer as long as you're putting all your water back down into the aquifer and drawing it out of the aquifer and keeping all of your water on site, is that a reasonable approach or not? And especially if you're saving all the infrastructure of a rainwater catchment system. Finally, sustainable water discharge septic system is what we used. Civilized work environment. Actually, this is a very civilized work environment. I would love to work here. This is up in the office, and one of the things that we did in this project was have this kind of light core. These are interior windows that go into each of the bedrooms. There's a skylight in this central area. The masonry stove goes up through this central area. But basically, we're sitting there at the desk, at the computer desk right there, looking down into the rest of the house. So good ventilation, good daylighting. There you can see the source control, keeping the dogs out with their dirty paws. they have an airlock entry, so, you know, two doors coming in, mudroom where they can take shoes off, drop their skis, drop their gear, take their coats off. It's also, it's unheated area. There's a little cellar down below for cold storage for potatoes or carrots or, you know, whatever root vegetables you might want, plus all the canning there. Ventilation, it's basically an exhaust system from the bathroom and the kitchen, and we do have, you know, bathroom and kitchen fans. Bathroom fan is on a timer so that they are getting adequate ventilation. One of the things, and the masonry stove does have a dedicated air supply, so it's not using any interior air. One of the things we struggled with was how to insulate with the crawl space or the floor or whatever. The client finally decided to insulate the floor. They've gone through the winter and they've decided, no, we really need to insulate the perimeter of the crawl space and seal that up a little bit more. And so that's, you know, still in process, and that's going to have a lot of, I think, really positive energy impacts over the next winter. And then beauty and inspiration, designing for spirit. One of the things you see when you go up to Winthrop and Twisp is just a lot of the really wonderful woods up there and the expressiveness of the woods. And so there is this whole shading system, indoor-outdoor living area, eating, large deck around the eastern part of the house. And then this is still under construction, but it's sort of a covered area that can be partially covered in the wintertime to provide some shading and then have screens that pull out for a screened-in porch right off the dining room for eating in the summertime. I don't know how many of you have seen Straw Bale projects, but they almost always have some sort of truth window. So there's our little truth window on the right-hand side. And it does seem as though this building, you know, honors the A-frame that was there and the sort of the history of the area, uses pretty much all native materials that are there. There's a handcrafted plaster inside, hand-colored plaster inside. Some of it, there's this wonderful blue room, and the blue is from chalk line chalk, which I love. the builder should appreciate that. And this is Dune Ives, her husband Eric Freud, and they're very committed to education. They are on various tours. They are always welcoming people into their house and talking about the house. Dune was part of a group that was trained by Al Gore for the climate project, and she's always giving presentations and talking about the house and you know, trying to get it published and show what you can do with a net zero energy house. And they do have, you know, plans in place for ongoing tours and ongoing education with the house. So how'd we do? You know, I'm kind of the green, yellow, red, simplistic approach here. You know, site design, pretty good. We're still trying to figure out the whole habitat exchange thing. Net zero energy, I think we will get there. They've elected not to put photovoltaic on the house yet because what they want to do is with the insulation and with the daylighting, they want to monitor their electric use for a year or so to see what their real needs are so they know what size photovoltaic system to put on. They're also waiting for all the panels and inverter to be produced in Washington so that they can get the higher credits. Washington has a pretty good incentive program. Materials, polyurethane, though I've heard from Tor that that might be moving to a different list, so we might hit some of those. Carbon footprint in process, responsible energy, a lot of question, or responsible industry, a lot of questions about FSC certification, and you know, I don't know if we made it there or not. I think there's a lot of open questions there. Same thing with the appropriate materials radius. Good, pretty good on construction waste. That might be maybe that should be a yellow with question marks. We obviously recycled everything we could in the local area. They actually have a large pile on site of things like insulation, rigid insulation, that they're trying to figure out what to do with that they may end up reusing. But it's not gone yet. But it hasn't been recycled yet, but it hasn't been trashed either. Net zero water, a lot of questions. Sustainable water discharge, a lot of questions. I think we did pretty well on the rest of them. So here we are. I just went to the petals and looked at where we were. You know, beauty and inspiration, sight, we're good. Indoor air quality, I think we're good. But, you know, we're probably at about 50%, and we'll see over the length of the life of the building how close we can get on all these and in conversations with Cascadia. Yes, and that is a question in terms of weight. Yeah, so I actually don't know. The client found that and installed it, so I need to figure out where that came from. Probably, and that would definitely knock us out on the materials. So.
Kelly, was the SAM system, how was that engineered? Like, it looked like, you know, your diagram had 2 feet of SAM, but it looked like a lot more than that was going into that.
Yeah, we actually decided, the diagram had 2 feet of sand. We decided, because I worked with Bob Ramlow, who's the author of the book. I brought him in as an engineer on the project, and we just talked about the size of the addition and how much sand was actually going into it, and wanted a little bit more depth. We also needed more depth for the frost line and the planting bed in the front, which also has drainage in the bottom, because, you know, obviously they have to water those plants, so we had to figure out how to drain it. Well, this is the thing with Bob, which makes me a little uneasy, is, you know, when I'm apt to sit down and figure out the specific gravity of sand and, you know, what is the heat storage capacity and try to figure out how much is going into it. And he is, the engineer, is more like, well, yeah, 32 inches, that sounds about right. And and so that's why I'm... You know, I want to monitor the system and see how it does. I don't know yet. But basically, a lot of those decisions were made with his guidance out of his experience in Wisconsin, which is about the same latitude and similar heating degree days. So I felt relatively comfortable with taking his advice. Yeah, well, there's two things. There's passive solar going on, obviously, and we tried to incorporate as much passive solar. So that's heating the top part of the slab just right off. And the masonry heater, we have huge thermal mass there that helps stabilize. But, yeah, basically the whole idea with the sand bed is that it will take you through the 2 weeks or the 3 weeks or the 2 months or whatever you have of time where you really need heat. And, you know, it's a slow system. You know, you're not going to be able to get up in the morning and turn on the heat. What it means is you might live at 65 degrees for 3 weeks and just put on a sweater and put on slippers. Well, I actually... how does one charge? Well, the way I charge is I look at the overall construction, and I come up with a scope of work, and I come up with a cap, and then I work to the cap. And if I make a decision to work beyond that, it's because it's for my own education and edification. But I did fine on this project. I didn't put in a lot of free time. Some of the other things, we did the whole straw bale workshop. We did a whole workshop that I was paid for all the way through, but there was a lot of community input in building the straw bale walls, wiring them, getting them ready for stucco. We did almost a week-long workshop, and that was another way that the client really gave back to the community, I think, in terms of providing a lot of education. Good question.
And I actually missed the first half of it.
The question was on the site selection, which is the number one. We have, what if the house or the building is already in an incorrect location according to the criteria? Do you not do anything to it?
Basically, the way we see it is that that house would actually never be eligible to be a living building because it was in one of those sites. So basically, over time, as it was retired, it should not be replaced with anything that would be considered a living building. So really, because we are trying to say that there are certain places just that should never be built on. And if there's a house previously built there, yes, it's we would love for the owners to bring it up to optimal, environmental performance, but it's still in a bad site. So eventually it should go away and be replaced with something in an appropriate location. So that's sort of the philosophy behind the appropriate site selection, if that makes sense.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Why did you choose the sand bed over Don Stevens ADS?
There's a question about why did I choose a water-based system as opposed to an air-based system. Don Stevens, who's a designer in Spokane, has a system where he basically heats the soil underneath a site or underneath a house. And one of the reasons that I didn't want to do that system is because the house was already there. And so, digging under it and putting pipes under it didn't seem that great.
But you still pulled it under the addition anyway, right?
Pardon?
You just did it under the addition anyway. There was no tubes under the apron.
No, exactly. I just have a lot of questions about Don's system. Don, like Bob, doesn't have a lot of math behind his system. But what he basically does is run large tubes or pipes under the ground, tries to heat up this whole basically bubble under the ground, under a house, and have insulation that goes out from the house in every direction. And I don't like the idea, quite personally, of sort of cutting off the soil from the rest of nature. It just doesn't seem like a good approach to me. And in terms of the sand bed, you're doing the stem wall anyway. You're doing a foundation anyway, unless you decide to do some sort of pier thing. So you're basically just filling the hole with an earth material that would have been there. And I like the idea of containing it a little bit more. It's very experimental. We have thermocouples in it. Talk to me in 3 or 4 years, and I'll tell you where I think its high points are and where I think its low points are.